As mentioned earlier, Silverado Trail is the other main drag in Napa Valley, with several wineries running along the mountains to the east of Highway 29. Ray Signorello owns and operates the winery that bears his family name near the Stag's Leap District on Silverado Trail. I interviewed Ray after a long day of pre-premier Napa Valley parties that were held in the valley, including one hosted by Signorello himself. After a Kobe beef burger and some fabulous Signorello Cabernet, I settled in for the interview in Ray's private office. I'm here at Ray Signorello's winery, and we are in, what part of Napa are we in, Ray?
Southeastern section. So we'd be on the Silverado Trail, probably, if you're familiar with the Stag's Leap area, we'd be about a half a mile south of there.
And how long have you been here?
That's going on 34 years.
So as I understand it, it was your dad and your mother who started the effort here?
Actually, interesting story. My father was born in San Francisco, as I was. At a young age, the family moved to Vancouver, Canada. So I grew up in Vancouver, Canada. Father one day wanted to find himself retired back in California. And his profession, he was in the mining business. And one of his other areas that he worked in was real estate. One of his partners, who lived in Las Vegas, used to own the ground that we're actually on, sitting on today. And he used to put his ex-race horses out to pasture there. So my father fell in love with the property. He made a deal with his partner and bought the property in 1977 with the original intent of building a retirement home and moving back from Vancouver, which never happened. So we had this piece of property. We decided to plant a little bit of it for some ambiance. So that's how we got started with the vineyard side of it. That's the easy side. You know, you plant a little piece of the property, you grow the grapes, you get a check once a year from a winery that's buying your fruit. So that took us to 1985, decided, well, let's try our hand at making a little bit of wine, more or less for fun. My father knew nothing about making wine, lived in Canada. I was still in business school in Canada. So it was kind of a steep learning curve, if you will. So the first three vintages, 85, 6, and 7, were made at another winery, and they call that Custom Crush. So they made the wine for us. 88 was the first vintage we made here on site at the estate. Built the winery, and that's really where I came into play. So I've been the operating managing partner, if you will, since day one. And my father didn't have any direct operational input into this business. He kind of acted as ambassador around the country when we'd go out and sell the wine, as he had his own career in the mining business. And both of us hadn't any experience in it, steep learning curve. I've been doing it now 20 plus years and fell in love with it over the years, obviously, and that's why I'm doing it.
So how old were you when you started that?
I was 23 years old.
Well, that's kind of young to be able to be in charge of this kind of operation, isn't it?
Yeah, it's kind of probably one of the youngest operators in the business at the time. So I've been doing it that many years. So it's and I don't feel I'm that old.
No, you don't look it. But I'm just trying to think at that age of 23. How did you feel with that kind of a responsibility?
Well, the winery was much different back then. I mean, it was really a two-person shop here. It was Steve Devitt, who did the day-to-day winemaking, and myself. And I used to, back then, as if you remember back then, there wasn't the computers that we have today, even that far back. I hand-did the accounting. I collected the money. I did the press kits, if you will, and I did all the marketing. So it was really just a two-person shop, and so I learned from the ground up, you know, from the get-go, really. And I found that to be really good to give me a grounding now when, as I'm hiring new people to take different pieces of my business. As the business expands, in any business, you know, you've got to delegate some things, some responsibility. And we went from two people to 22 people currently. So, but I've done all those different pieces, and I think it's a good way to learn the business. My business school background obviously helped on the running of the business, and I have a passion for wine. I have a personal wine cellar that has 8,000 to 10,000 bottles right now, and I've used that as kind of research and development, if you will. You know, it's my R&D for making better wines here on the estate. So a lot of other folks, you know, take different angles, different tacks for doing it. Mine really comes from a passion of wine. So if I didn't own a winery, I still have a passion for the wine side of it. I travel to Europe quite extensively and use what I learned from people who have been doing it for a long time. incorporate what they know into my own product. And I think that's really what gives us the quality is owner is the winemaker as well. So we kind of like a restaurant where the chef is the owner. I follow that same kind of path here at the Signorello Winery.
So just let's talk about your cellar for a couple of minutes here. Tell me what you have in that cellar. That 8 to 10,000 bottles, that's a respectable cellar.
You know, I've been collecting since 85, and my tastes have changed over the years. So originally I was more interested in those big, ripe, powerful wines, maybe that lack some finesse. And over the years, I've kind of, I think you appreciate the nuances in wines as you learn more about wine. Wines that go well with food, they're complementary, they age well, they have complexity and nuances. To that end, you know, I have a lot of European wine in my cellar, good European wine from both Italy and France, obviously California wine as well, and then wines from Oregon and Washington State and other parts. But I probably have a like of European wine more than some in the local areas here. And what I appreciate from them, I incorporate them into my wines. And that's balance and subtlety and nuance and complexity, age-worthiness, not high alcohol and oaky, and a lot of those kind of characters have come out in the last 10 to 15 years because a lot of the popular press has written about them as being great wines, and it's really not my favorite kind of wine.
What kind of output do you have here at Signorello?
Signorello is mostly Cabernet, in about 7,500 cases a year. I think what really differentiates us from a lot of people in the New World is we are a true estate-grown and bottled winery, and by that I mean we grow our grapes on the property, the winery's on the property. We do everything from start to finish here, and it's owned by a family, myself. It's not a corporation here, so it's a real hands-on, family-owned estate winery that's, now we're getting our 26th year of making wine. So we have, by Sonoma-Napa standards, a pretty good history. By European standards, still young.
I think it's amazing, though, because I see you as young, because I'm a little older, and to have that many years behind you is pretty amazing. That's a wealth of experience, especially considering the history that's taken place in those 26 years.
Yeah, it's all a learning curve. Hopefully, I think I've improved my craft. So I think the best wines we're making are today, partially because I've learned over the years about making great wine, making better and better wine, and you can never be perfect. So it's you get one chance a year to make it, and it's a little different business than others. A restaurant or some other kind of business, you get every day you can improve. You know, even what you do, you know, you can come away from this and tomorrow you can say, I would have done it a little differently and adjust for the next day. When I make my wine, I can't make an adjustment to the next vintage. In my lifetime, I'd be lucky to get 60 chances. So you got to be good. You got to get it right. You got to learn quickly. Have good people around you. I think that's important. And that's why I travel a lot. And that's why I try to read as much as I can and visit these great wineries of Europe and kind of soak up what the knowledge they have through both their personal knowledge, but also their wines. When I taste their wines, I get an idea of what they've done and what I need to do here.
So is your model more of a European wine? Is that the direction you're headed?
Yeah, by European, I mean in Europe now, there's the lines have been blurred too. So when I say European, I say wines of the old world styled wines that are not quite as ripe. You know, they have a nice balance of acidity to tannin, some complexity. You know, our vines here now are 20 to 30 years old on the estate, and the yields are very low by local standards. And we're talking anywhere from a ton to 3 tons an acre. So we're not making a lot of wine per acre, but we think really good quality. And you need great grapes to make good or great wine. It doesn't, you can't just manufacture that. The only way really to make great wine is having a good piece of property. It's easier to do it when you have your own piece of property. It's harder to buy good grapes or great grapes. So we're lucky in that respect that we've got, you know, just under 100 acres here, and about 45 acres of these acres are planted. We have some more to go. You know, it's a learning curve in the vineyard side too. As you plant different clones and rootstocks, you find out what works best on your site, and then the next piece that you plant, you try to incorporate that what you've learned on that. And you know, we're just about to plant another 5 to 10 acres over the next couple of years, and I think what I've learned over the last 20, it's going to help me on these next 5 or 10.
And what are you planning on planting?
Cabernet. It'll be all Cabernet. Cabernet is what Napa does best and what we're known for. We do have a few other things planned. We have a 30-year-old Chardonnay vineyard on this property, which is wonderful Chardonnay, but a very small piece of it. We do a true white Bordeaux blend, a Semillon Sauvignon Blanc blend we call Seta. Seta is an Italian word, means silk. That's our proprietary name for the wine. We have Syrah on the estate, so we make a traditional Cote Roti blend, co-fermented with Viognier. We make a couple of wines for fun that we actually, I go to a couple of neighbors, like Pinot Noir. We can't grow great Pinot Noir in our state, so I love Pinot Noir, so we go to a friend down in Carneros, and the vineyard's called Los Amigos, and make just a few barrels a year for house use almost.
Really nice to be able to make wine for house use.
Yeah.
Of course, that's an Italian tradition, isn't it? Is your family, was your dad first generation, or you, or...
My grandparents came over here in 1904 from Sicily and Calabria. My father was born in San Francisco, as I was, so we're both local or native San Franciscans. As I mentioned, I had moved to Canada at a young age, to Vancouver, and came back in the 80s, essentially to run this business. So I do have a home in Vancouver, so I do go back and forth. I'm involved in the wine distribution business in Canada. So I kind of used my knowledge of the wine business to be vertically integrated, and I represent a bunch of other wineries in Canada and sell their wines in Canada, as well as my own.
Are you distributing primarily American wines there?
We represent wines of the world. So we represent European wines, Australian wines, New Zealand wines, South American wines. Our goal is to represent great wines, and by definition, those are wines that are owned by somebody that cares, that has a passion, handcrafted. I tend to steer myself away from big brand wines that are, usually when there's a big brand attached to it, you're paying a price for that. And not to say there's not great brands out there, but I'm looking for the passion on the winemaking and ownership side that is beyond just the brand, and that means more. That what's in the bottle is really somebody's labor of love. That's kind of guided me through this business. I found a real passion for what I do. I enjoy it. And if I wasn't doing this, I'd hope I'd find something else that I loved equally well.
Passion's the key word, too, isn't it? It's the word that comes up commonly in these interviews.
Yeah, and it's there's a lot of people that that are in this wine business for that reason. The return on your capital isn't so good in this business, as you probably heard before, but your return on living, your lifestyle is—it's a wonderful lifestyle, and it's one of the true businesses you can take from the dirt all the way to the consumer. When you really think about it, there isn't much that you can do that with. And we have the ability to take something right off my dirt, plant those vines, and years later see somebody drinking that wine at dinner. And because wine ages well in the bottle, it could be 50 years later. Or more.
So for the future, Signorello, is there, I don't know what your family situation is, do you envision that if you do already have kids, that they would eventually move into it since it started with family?
Yeah, these businesses, the wonderful part about it is you hand a legacy on to somebody, but they have to want to inherit that legacy. And sometimes growing up in a family business, you go, it's not what I want to do. You almost don't want to do it because it's what your parents did. In my case, a little different because, my parents and I had different interests in the world, and my father was in the mining business. I wasn't interested in the mining business. Together, we like wine, and really it started as, something my father and I really as a hobby. And so I didn't grow up in it. I think that's why I really appreciate it, because it's kind of more or less something that I've taken from ground zero to today. And built it from a vineyard to a winery. And then I've ended up expanding the line. I've started two other winery projects, one called Edge from Napa, which is a Cabernet project, and one called Fuse, which is another Cabernet project. And I took what I learned from Signorello and used all the pieces of the business to come up with two Cabernets that are very good quality and very well priced. So they're more affordable than Signorello, made in larger quantities than Signorello. So Edge is about a 15,000 case brand, and Fuse is about a 6,000 case brand. And each one has its own kind of target. Edge is a little more New World styled, It's Cabernet with a little bit of Merlot, and edge, as the name sounds. The tagline is a cutting edge wine without the cutting edge price. Fuse was something else, a relatively new project of mine, and it was patterned after an Italian wine by the name of Guadalatasso, which is a very well-known Antinori wine, where they blend Cabernet, Merlot, and Syrah. So I did that in Napa, Cabernet, Merlot, Syrah. Fuse, kind of a play on words, fusion of those varietals. A little more European in style than the Edge, but also very successful, and also very well priced. So these would both be about $20 retail, American retail wines, which from Napa for Cabernet is aggressively priced.
Those are separate from Signorello.
They're not, as you notice when you're here today at Signorello, you haven't seen a bottle of those wines because they're not anything to do with Signorello. Signorello is a standalone estate. Edge and Fuse are not made here, and we keep them completely separate.
Where can people find your wines?
Well, we are distributed around the U.S. in most of the major markets, as well as Canada, which is one of my other homes. That makes sense. We sell a little bit in Europe, a little bit in Asia. The same would hold true for Fuse and Edge as well. But we also have a pretty good direct-to-consumer presence here at the winery. To mention quickly, we started this project last year called Enoteca Signorello. We have our own kitchen, full kitchen here, as well as in-house chef. Everybody's probably familiar with the tasting room experience. You come to a winery, you get a glass, come to the tasting bar and taste some wine, and sometimes it can be very busy. It could be 50 people in front of you in the tasting bar. And it's hard to, one, learn about the winery and the wines, and to get a real quality experience. So we thought, let's elevate this to a more European-styled experience. And I learned by going to Europe, visiting these wineries, a lot of them don't even have a tasting bar. You sit down in their salon, they serve some food. I said, that's what we're going to do. So we built a salon downstairs here in the just below this office, and we seat 10 people down at a time, twice a day, 7 days a week. And we serve usually four different flights of food and match that with our wines with fine Riedel glassware, with somebody sitting down and talking about the wines, the experience, the winery, the history over an hour and a half period, so that they come away with one, some wonderful food paired with some wonderful wines, and also a real good hands-on experience that they just didn't hear 2 second blurb from the tasting bar salesperson, but they heard something from somebody that wanted to talk to them and tell them, you know, what care goes into these wines. So that's something we started about a year ago. It's been well received. I think that's the future. On the weekends, we have an outdoor wood burning oven, pizza oven, and we do the traditional Italian thin crust pizzas. We sit people down outside, beautiful weather. Napa's known for its weather. So between April and October, we sit people down and they get to experience these little pizzas that go with our wines. And then as kind of a finish, I hadn't mentioned with the Enoteca, we have a partnership with Snake River Farms. Today you got to experience a little bit of their wonderful product. Snake River Farms is, I would say, probably the most highly regarded American Kobe beef producer. And we partnered with them to market both of our products about 4 years back. They're family-owned, known for great product, as we are. What better experience to pair great American Kobe beef with great Napa Valley Cabernet? And that they're a great match, so that's what we do. And we serve some of that at the weekends with the pizzas. When the pizza's finished, we come back with some sliced American Kobe beef. And we also serve that. We use a different cut, the filet cut, in the Enoteca experience. So people have heard about Kobe beef. You know, it's a very special product, and it's quite expensive, it's quite dear, but we let people experience it. And it just goes so well with Napa Cabernet, with the heavy tannin, rich wine, the marbled content, the marbled fat content of the Kobe beef, just kind of, it's hard to describe, you gotta do it. And so if anybody's finding themselves in Napa Valley, please look us up, and love to guide you through that experience.
I think the great thing about what you're doing, especially the keyword being experience, is because the quality you put into the bottle, you're also putting the quality into the salesmanship of the bottle. So yeah, that's a little bit different than what some folks are doing.
Right. I'm a big believer in customer service, and we didn't grow up drinking wine. You know, we all grew up having steaks and hamburgers, and we know usually what a good one is. But wine in America is something that is not quite as well known as it is in Europe. So people, you know, have to look to others to say what's good, what's not good. They have to learn. And, you know, I remember I didn't know a thing about wine back 20, 25 years ago. And I still don't know that much, probably. You know, it's a never-ending learning experience. We want people to come away from Signorello and say, great experience. We learned something. We also learned that wine isn't meant to be served by itself. It's meant to go with food. Again, that's another European tradition that makes sense.
Oh, you served it with great food today because you threw a really nice party. One last question, and this is one I've asked every owner, winemaker I've talked to. How do you feel about the existence of screw caps versus corks?
It's definitely a positive, there's a future for it. Unfortunately, the public perception in the high-end wine area is negative. You know, if I was to put my top-end wines and finish them with a screw cap, the public's just not ready to accept that and embrace that yet. Now, that's really just because of our history, and one day that'll change. It's a long evolution. My kind of quick answer is when Chateau Margaux or Mouton Rothschild starts using screw caps, then you know I'll start myself. But there's still some parts we have to work out. I mean, there's some reduction issues. Some people have had issues with reduction in their wines. I don't want to get too technical, but it has a future. It's great, especially for inexpensive, younger drink me now white wines. Long term, probably, I mean, if we look 100 years down the road, probably we will go that way. But what's kind of counteracting that a bit is the romance of a cork. You know, there still is that. At a restaurant, the waiter comes to the table, the sommelier, and serves a fine bottle of wine to you and just rolls the screw cap off. It just doesn't have the same cachet as pulling the cork. Now, that's preconceived notion because we grew up that way. Down the road, I'd say, you know, it only makes sense. Whether it's 20 years, 30 years, or 100 years, one day I think we're going to get away from our corks because, of, you know, there is that issue that 2 out of every 100 bottles of wine are corked. People don't realize that, and they're drinking wine, they just don't like it, and they don't recognize it as corked because nobody might have taught them that. And I've actually sat with people that even should know better, and they don't recognize it themselves, you know, so it's... Corkiness is, there's every level from hard to perceive all the way up to badly corked where it smells like musty cardboard and moldy. So if you ever get a wine like that, it's corked. Best way to find out if it's corked or not is open up a second bottle of the same wine. Usually you don't get two in a row, so the second one's a lot different than the first one. Uh-huh. A quick little fun story. I was in Germany. This was about 10 years ago. I was in Germany. I went to a fine restaurant there in Frankfurt, and ordered a nice bottle of wine. Came out, sommelier had his chains around his neck, his little tastevin, they call it, the little cup, came there, poured the wine in my glass, said, do you like it? And I just kind of quickly sniffed it. He went away, he came back, he says, so what do you think of the wine? I said, well, I think there's something wrong with it. And he looked at me, and then he got his cup out, and he tasted the wine. He says, well, I think it's fine. And I said, you know, and I looked like I was younger than him, and he's pushing it a little bit that the wine was fine. I thought to myself, well, I don't think it's fine. So what am I going to do? I told the guy, I said, well, bring me back another bottle of the same wine, serve them both to me blind so I don't know which one's which, and if I can point out the corked wine, then we have a corked wine. If not, I'll buy both from you. So he came back, brought both wines, served in front of me. I didn't even taste it, I just smelled it. Pointed to it, smelled it, and said, that's corked. And I said, you try them. The sommelier sheepishly sniffed each glass and says, you're right. But he didn't know I was a winery owner. So if I'm getting that kind of treatment, and I own a winery, I've been doing it for years, I know that there's issues that have been perpetuated out there by certain people in the wine industry. And, you know, obviously we got to get past that because we don't want to make this a difficult, snobbish, elitist style. Wine is wine. It's meant to be enjoyed. It's not anything more than a beverage, albeit a great beverage. And it's meant to complement food. And they get it in the old world. They sometimes look to us in the new world and go, you're making too big a deal out of this. So we got to demystify it. And I think... you know, that's, we try to do that here at the winery. I live that life, you know. I'm not, it's not an elitist thing. everybody should enjoy a great bottle of wine every day.
You just read our mission statement, you know that. But again, the idea of, you know, not taking it so dead seriously. The other thing unique in the wine industry is one of the few industries that solidly stands behind their product if there is a corked bottle of wine. Any restaurant, any distributor is always going to gladly take that wine back, and the customer is going to get something back for it. I mean, that's unique in our country these days, wouldn't you agree?
Yeah, obviously we accept that, and that we're going to have a certain amount of corked bottles of wine. And my hope would be we'd never serve a corked bottle of wine out in the market. It's hard to control, though. A restaurant serves it, and a lot of restaurants don't even have that interaction. So they just pull the cork and pour the wine, and it's up to the customer to decide whether to send it back or not. So I'm sure somebody's had a bottle or two of my wine over the years where it's been corked and possibly said, I just don't like their wine. That's the problem we live with. It's getting better and better as the time moves on. You know, more restaurants are seeing the value of making sure their customer's getting a nice bottle of wine. And to be honest, I mean, if you look at the profitability of a restaurant, I mean, a lot of it depends on selling wine. So they should take care of the product. They're making up a good profit on each bottle of wine they open. In a lot of ways, it's a lot easier for them to just pull a cork and serve, you know, do it properly, use nice glassware, then cook the dinner and buy the food. You know, most of the hard work with the wine is done back here at the winery.
Well, that was a great story, though, and a unique story for our listeners to hear, and I appreciate that because I don't think even I would have thought of that idea of asking for a second bottle. It's very smart because people can go, hey, here's an approach I can take if I feel like I'm under the gun. Ray, online, where can people find your wines?
Well, our website is signorelloestate.com. That's an easy way to reach us. You could email us through the website. You can get our phone numbers there. We accept online orders. We have a wonderful wine club, and I'll spell that out for you. It's SIGNORELLO estate, estate.com. As mentioned, we also have an Anatech tasting experience here at the winery that you can book online. Our wines are represented around the country, so you can find them in your fine bottle shops as well as your fine restaurants. That goes for the two other winery projects, Edge and Fuse. If you're interested in looking at Edge, it's edgewines.com, E-D-G-E, wines, W-I-N-E-S.com. And the other one is Fuse, as in lighting the fuse, F-U-S-E, wine, singular. So it's fusewine, W-I-N-E.com. You can find those wines through both of those websites.
Great. Ray, I know it's a busy weekend and you've had a busy day, and this has been all the events going on linked to Premier have probably kept you running around the valley. So I want to say thanks very, very much for your time. I appreciate it.
I appreciate it. Good to meet you.